the world's perspective. It's not God's. It's not the perspective of those of us who believe in this gospel. The word scandalous actually refers to that which is shocking or offensive or outrageous or shameful. Doesn't make sense. At least that's how the world uses the word. And the unchristian world views biblical Christianity as contemptible, deserving scorn, ridicule, derision. Now, we're going to hear different versions of the word scandalous. In fact, I know Dan's lesson on Sunday morning, he's going to talk more directly about scandalous from the biblical perspective, because the Bible talks about scandalous too, but in a little bit different manner, and we're going to find out what that means. So the point I'm trying to make here is that the message that we preach to many people is a foolish one. In fact, I've been told, you've probably been told too, if you've been a Christian for any length of time, that we're ridiculed because we pray to an imaginary friend, or that our religion is really just a crutch for the simple-minded people that can't really handle life on their own. They need religion to, you know, help them walk them through that. The Bible is filled with fairy tales and contradictions. And meekness is viewed as weakness. Forgiveness is what people do who don't have the guts to carry out vengeance and retribution. And our hero, apparently to some, is a delusional, uneducated opportunist. And that, of course, referring to Jesus himself. So it's not just something that appears foolish, like someone says, well, I just disagree with that, or I just don't want to accept that, but it seems altogether backward. And that's really where the rub is right there. You know, that the world is looking at what the Bible teaches and what God has revealed to us, presented to us, and it just simply says, you know what, that defies all logic and reason. And I'll give you some examples of that, because I want to see some examples. I want you to see some examples of that as well. For example, if God wants everyone to be saved, like he says he does, then why does he make the way to salvation so narrow? Why does he make it so hard? According to worldly thinking, salvation ought to be the easiest thing possible, certainly not the hardest. There should be no hoops, no commandments, no responsibilities, no sacrifices. You know, just save us, right? I mean, that's how the world thinks about this. And there is a very real group of people out there that embody that very sentiment there. If God loves us so much, as he claims that he does, then why does he threaten to destroy us if we don't love him back? To the world, that just seems outrageous. It seems very unnatural. In fact, it seems very unnecessary. In the world's mind, since love is unconditional, then salvation ought to be unconditional. If anyone's going to be in need of it at all, then it should be unconditional. Why separate the two? Why make love unconditional but salvation conditional? That seems outrageous, scandalous even, ridiculous. If Jesus has as much authority and jurisdiction as he claims, Matthew 28, verse 18, he says that he has all authority in heaven and on earth, and why is there so much religious confusion and division and error? Why doesn't he just spell everything out for us and remove all doubt? I mean, why be so mysterious and, you know, indirect? Why not just have volumes and volumes of Bibles, right? And that gets to the next point. If the Bible provides what is supposed to be the most important information known to man, as Christians claim that it is, then why is it so limited in what it says? If you go to law firms or engineering firms, you know, there'll be all kinds of bookshelves full of manuals and descriptions and schematics and legal codes and all kinds of things. I mean, just walls of books. And here, the most important message to man is condensed to one book? That seems pretty scandalous, doesn't it? That seems kind of ridiculous and a bit outrageous to make such a claim like that. You can see where the world is coming from when it says things like that. And if Christianity is the noblest religion in the world, as Christians claim that it is, then why is it so marginalized? Why is it so ridiculed? Why is it so despised? And why does it seem to be so seemingly ineffective? Non-Christians have, I'm told anyway, little concern about morals, ethics, chastity, integrity, self-control, and they claim to be happy. How come Christians are so uptight about all these things? I mean, I'm saying this from the world's perspective, that this is how the world sees us, or more importantly, this is how the world sees the gospel. And it calls it a scandal. When it sees it like that, when it portrays it like that. There's another aspect to that, though, that we want to get to, and that this speaks really to the paradoxical nature of the Christian faith. I'm talking about the Christian belief system. On one hand, it is scandalous. It is offensive. It seems disgraceful, at least from the world's perspective. But on the other hand, here's the paradox, nothing else has ever been shown to be superior to it in the godless world or in any other religion. That begs the question, well, what do you mean by paradox? Well, a paradox actually comes to us from Latin, which actually comes to us from Greek. Originally, the paradoxon is a Greek word, a compound word, para meaning against, and then doxos, which means to think. Literally, it means against thinking. Not against thinking rationally, but against expectation of thought. It's counterintuitive, in other words. It's counterintuitive thinking that runs contrary to one's expectation or to one's existing beliefs or to one's opinions. The world claims to have everything figured out, and then the Bible comes along and challenges what the world thinks it's figured out. And so the world then blames the gospel for being backward and for being not right and for being irrational. And yet we're going to find as we go along through this series that it's quite the opposite. The world doesn't have everything figured out. God does have everything figured out. And it is the world that is backwards. If you want a more technical definition here, Merriam-Webster says, paradoxical means a seemingly absurd or self-contradictory statement or proposition that when investigated or explained may prove to be well-founded or true. And I'll give you some examples of that. Say someone says, well, in order to see something more clearly, you need to step away from it. Well, that doesn't make sense because if you step away, then you get further away. How can you see it more clearly if you get further away? But you know that that is actually true. It doesn't seem to be true up front, but actually it is. That's what a paradox refers to. Or someone says, someday you'll be old enough to be young again, right? Anyone hear about that? Okay, and there is a grain of truth to that. It doesn't seem to make sense at first, and yet you realize that the older you get, then that makes more sense. Or peace is only achieved through war and conquest. That's another paradoxical statement. Or what Jesus says in Matthew 16, verse 25, whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. Well, that's a paradoxical statement, because up front it just doesn't seem to make sense, and yet it makes more sense than ever once you understand it in its context. Or perhaps one of the most paradoxical statements ever made, Paul says, when I am weak, then I am strong. Well, that just doesn't make sense at all. Unless, of course, you look at it from Paul's perspective, which is in the spiritual context, and then it most certainly does make sense. That's in 2 Corinthians 12, verse 10. So the gospel of Christ is actually founded upon a series of paradoxical concepts. Joy is achieved through sorrow. Peace comes to us through adversity. Greatness comes through humility. Leadership through service. Life comes through death. And this is all counterintuitive to all human or earthly or typical expectations and opinions. In other words, people expect this over here. They expect this scenario or this result over here, and yet the Bible takes it over here instead. And while it is counter to human and earthly expectations, it is proven to be true as demonstrated over time and countless examples. I want to be real clear on this point here that a paradox is not a lie that God makes true. It's not like God starts out with a lie and then after a lot of massaging and twisting and manipulating, it finally comes out true. That's a horrible way to think about this in this discussion here. It is an absolute truth that appears to the spiritual or self-serving world to run counter to human nature and, can I say, self-preservation, because that's a lot of what drives the world's thinking is self-preservation. The world, as you know, takes the path of least resistance. God chooses what appears to be the path of most resistance, not because he is backward, but because the world is backward, and his ways, his thoughts, his methods are actually superior to that of the world's. I haven't gotten into the proof of all that, and we may not prove it satisfactorily to you this weekend, but it is consistent. That is what we consistently see about God's message, that it is superior to what the world provides. So we can sum this up with this things are not always as they seem approach, which really is a major theme of the book of Revelation. If anyone studied that, not thinking about the whole science fiction aspect of that, but thinking about what it really talks about, which is God telling Christians who are under great duress to recant their faith under pressure, he's telling them to stay the course. And what he tells them in so many words is these things. The world seems to be in a superior position because it has numbers on its side. But God's basically saying to Christians, to the church, and to anyone who would listen, that numbers really don't matter with God. He's never been impressed with them, and he's never needed numbers in order to be victorious. That's something to think about. And also, Christians seem to be inferior to, say, atheism or secularism because ultimately, you know, we rely on that extremely weak link in all of what we do, and that's called faith. As a basis for our belief, but we come to find out that that's not an inferior or weakness, inferior approach or a weakness in itself whatsoever. In fact, many are coming around to understand that it takes far more faith to be an atheist than it does a Christian. That's another discussion, but nonetheless, we could prove that if we took the time. Evil seems to be more powerful than righteousness because it's far more prevalent and it's far more popular. But that's based on a false perception of people and also an active ministry of misinformation by Satan and those who listen to him. So there's another thing to consider there. Evil seems to be powerful, seems to be more powerful, but in fact it's not. Christians seem to be outmatched by the strength of their opponents. But our warrior king, as he is presented in Scripture as a warrior king, is the most powerful leader in the entire universe. And he has proven his superiority over Satan, over demons, over the world, over death itself. There is no one more powerful than that. In other words, the world seems to have an upper hand, but things are not always as they seem. And for all its talk, all its heckling, all its resistance, and all its contempt for the Christian faith, every person ultimately will die. And then what? And how do they know that for certain? And that's a point that should be brought up in discussions like this. It all sounds good until you die. And then what? Now what about your beliefs then? I'm going to spend a little time here talking about really the alternative. Okay, if not Christianity, what else do we have? What else do we have to look at? Lately, in our secular world, in modern history, we've been witnessing a swelling contempt, a scorn. I think it can be even characterized as a rage in some cases against the Christian belief system because it seems so ridiculous. It seems to be such a scandalous idea. And this series will offer a response, but first, I want to see what the godless, irreligious world believes. And then just simply ask ourselves, which seems more scandalous? Which seems more unreasonable? Which seems to be more preposterous? The world claims that there is no God, that God has been invented by religious zealots seeking power and control over people. And yet, it cannot prove that there is no God. And it cannot disprove all the evidence that does exist for God. Really, the burden of proof lies on those who say that there is no God. First of all, prove that. And then secondly, prove something better than that. Okay? There's a double proof that is required on the part of those who say that. I've got a picture up here. This is actually an atheistic campaign that came out several years ago where they had posters all over buses and buildings and everything that says there's probably no God. I just love that word, probably. Okay, let's just concede the point. There's probably no God, but then what are you going to fill life with? How are you going to explain things? And then there's that sticking point. What if the probably isn't proved to be true? What if there probably is a God? Now what? And then what does that require of us? I've been told all my life that Christianity is irrational because Christians believe in things that we can't see or know or prove scientifically. And yet, the world believes that everything began with the Big Bang, a cataclysmic explosion that instead of destroying everything in the process, which we know that explosions do, it actually organized everything. In fact, it actually improved everything. In fact, it actually came up with laws to organize and improve everything all by itself in the midst of an explosion. This is what the world believes. This is what the world teaches. And I'm not saying this to ridicule the world. I'm saying this because this is what the world teaches. Think about 9/11, for example. We just celebrated, if that's the right word, or honored or memorialized the 15th anniversary of the towers coming down, the attacks on America. I just want you to keep, I know you all have this in your mind, the picture of those towers collapsing and then all that huge rubble that created. And out of that, just imagine if we take the evolutionist, the atheistic, or the, you know, the worldly secular perspective, out of all that rubble, out of the ashes, the phoenix arose, or whatever, you know, the order and organization and complexity arose out of that. Well, no, that's not what happened. And that would never happen. But if you throw eons of time at it, then it'll get better, is what I'm always told. But that doesn't happen. And it will never happen that way. The world claims that the Bible is actually a fairy tale. Despite all the evidence that it's not, it still says that. It's a fairy tale. And yet it promotes what really might be considered the biggest fairy tale of all. That is of unnamed, invisible, impersonal, amoral, so-called blind forces of nature that are responsible for everything that exists. These things are never identified. They're never explained. They're just simply assumed into existence. Let me tell you, that is irrational. That is not scientific. It is not scientific to create a phony blind forces of nature to explain everything when you have no evidence for such blind forces in the first place, and they don't even do anything, or you can't even, you know, pin a name to them. The world believes that all life on Earth descended from a single-celled common ancestor that mysteriously and accidentally and yes, even unscientifically, willed itself into life forms far more complex than it itself. Now, this doesn't even take into account how did that thing get into being, but it simply says that that thing, now that it willed itself into existence, now betters itself over eons of time. Again, irrational, unscientific, but this is what the world is desperately clinging to. This is their answer. Instead of a creator who created everything, this is what they come up with. And they look at us and they say, scandalous, preposterous, outrageous that you believe in a God, but we believe in blind forces of nature that took a single-celled organism and turned it eventually into the human race. And again, I'm not saying that to ridicule them, but there's a ridiculousness to that idea. It's an insult to the human intelligence to think like that. Speaking of thinking, Dr. Daniel Siegel, professor of clinical psychiatry at UCLA School of Medicine, has written a book about the human brain called The Developing Mind. I quote, "The brain is a complex system of interconnected parts. At its most basic level, the skull-based portion of the nervous system consists of over 100 billion neurons and trillions of supportive glia cells. Each neuron has an average of 10,000 connections that directly link it to other neurons. Thus, there are thought to be about 1 million billion of these connections, making it, the brain, the most complex structure, natural or artificial, on Earth." So let that sink into your brain for just a minute. What he just said was that this single-celled organism somehow created the most complex organism on Earth without any guidance, without a blueprint, without any superintelligence, without any purpose. And we're coming back and saying, how in the world did you get to that? There is no good answer to that. That is completely irrational, completely subjective, certainly not scientific. Blind forces and eons of time doesn't correct all of that. The problem here is too great for that. If something is naturally impossible today, it will always be naturally impossible. If nature doesn't, you know, unless nature is constantly changing itself, which is a wild card that everyone wants to come up with, and that's a convenient scapegoat, unless nature is always changing, then if it's unscientific and irrational a billion years ago, then it's still going to be today. If a rock is a rock a billion years ago, it's still going to be today. It's just not going to change. The world believes in Darwinism, which says survival of the fittest. And yet the world also condemns genocide, murder, terrorism, and is also seeking ways to eradicate cancers and diseases. This is irrational. This is contradictory. I'm not saying that we shouldn't look for disease or answers to disease and medicines and so on. My point here is that it's completely contradictory to what it teaches. If it really is survival of the fittest, well, then the fittest should survive and the unfit people should die. I mean, let's just be consistent, right? I'm not being cold and ruthless here. I'm just simply trying to be consistent with what the world is teaching us. But then it goes out and speaks out of the other side of its mouth and says, no, it's wrong to murder or kill or genocide and all these other things. Like, we can't have it both ways. Similarly, the world believes in a thing called Darwinism, natural selection, which means letting nature decide who gets to live and who doesn't. And yet the world also gets, at the same time, very upset when physical nature decides to kill people in earthquakes and tornadoes and tsunamis and plague. This is irrational. This is contradictory. This is unscientific. This is not an answer. Again, we have the world promoting something that just doesn't make sense. The world scoffs at God or the idea of God and yet sets its telescopes and listening devices into empty space, hoping to communicate with an extraterrestrial. Do you see the irony there? Just for a moment. Just let that sink in. People say, well, we can't be the only intelligent life in the universe, and yet that whole concept, that statement, is actually based on evolution, which we have just shown time after time and could continue to show time after time to be irrational and unscientific in the first place. So now we have a premise that is irrational, and then we make statements that seem to be rational, like we're going to look for aliens out there, when the fact is the only way that aliens could exist, if at all, would be if evolution existed, which it doesn't. And by the way, if you didn't get what I said earlier, God is the ultimate extraterrestrial, and he has communicated with us, and he's being ignored and rejected by many of those who are looking for other extraterrestrials. The point I'm making here is that the very group that claims that Christianity is irrational because we believe in an invisible God is itself riddled with contradictions, false claims, unscientific stories peddled as truth and science and reason. The world thinks that the gospel is scandalous, but there's nothing more scandalous than an irrational, contradictory propaganda being promoted as though it's true when it's not. That's scandalous. There's the real scandal right there. The world operates under this backward paradox, if we can say it that way. Instead of seemingly false but actually true, like the Bible actually is, paradoxically, it's actually false but is counted as true, is actually false, but yet promoted as or purported to be truth. Well, there's, again, backward paradox. The world blames Christianity for all of its troubles, and yet what actually plagues society, all the vices that plague society, greed, gambling, substance addiction, alcoholism, sorcery, lying, theft, murder, domestic violence, pornography, racism. Paradoxically, all of these things are the exact same things that Christianity opposes and actually works to overcome. In other words, imagine the world if Christianity was suddenly flooded throughout the world and everyone started believing in it. It would actually start combating all these things, these plagues upon society that we just talked about. And the world resists that. By resisting us, or more importantly, by resisting God, resisting his message, it actually resists a solution to its own problem. The world claims to uphold moral virtue, altruism, charity, benevolence, honesty, integrity, decency, love. You hear that all the time. Paradoxically, these are all things that Christianity not only advocates and practices, but all of those things originated ultimately from and were defined in originally the Bible itself. They got that from the Bible. So I want you to think about what's going on. The world is saying, oh, you idiot people, you've got this silly faith and this mysterious imaginary friend in the sky that you pray to, and this world ridicule with, lies and falsity and everything else, even though no one ever proves that. But the point is that we just reject all that, and yet we want exactly what it teaches. Isn't that paradoxical? Or certainly isn't that scandalous? The world wants really what Christianity offers. That's what it really wants. And that just doesn't make sense. Here's another point to make that you might not have thought about before. For Christianity to work, it only needs to have a single premise proved. One single premise. And that premise is the existence of an all-powerful, all-knowing, sovereign God. Because once that premise is proven, and once that premise is accepted and there's plenty of evidence available to support that premise, then everything else about that God or that comes from that God or is that revealed by that God is not only believable, but is rational and true. But with evolution, or humanism, or atheism, or whatever you want to call it, you have to accept a myriad of premises. There's not just one. There's a lot of them. You can't just say, well, God doesn't exist, because that can't be proven. You also have to prove everything else that is wrong with evolution and a godless universe actually has a rational explanation, which it doesn't. I've given you just a sampling of things tonight that it can't explain, other than trying desperately to grasp at things that just don't make sense and still calling it science. So all we need to do in order for this Bible to be true and in order for us to believe in it without being fools and so on is to know that there is a God, there is a creator. What evolution and the secular world needs to know is a whole lot more things than that, and it needs to prove them, and it needs to prove them sufficiently, and yet it cannot do that. Christianity is based on the Bible. There's no denying that, and particularly the teachings of Jesus Christ and his apostles in the New Testament. Jesus was not some crazy heretic with false claims and zero proofs, with no connection to sacred writings that actually were made hundreds of years before his time. Rather, Jesus was a man who fulfilled everything written about him by authentic prophets of God. In other words, we have well-documented oracles or well-documented prophecies. Not just a couple, we have many well-documented prophecies which he fulfilled. He was the worker of numerous miracles. He demonstrated supernatural power. And I want you to think about that. If he's a fraud, how could he do that? And if there is no God, then how could he do that? If there is no God, then the world is entirely materialistic and mechanical. There is no supernatural aspect to it all. By the way, if there is no God and evolution is true, you have no soul. You have nothing else but what you have sitting on the pew right now. That's it. There is nothing else. You die, you just disappear. Even though no one can prove that, but that's what it teaches. But Jesus provided miracles or miraculous power and proved that there is something more than this physical, visible world. And these are proofs not only of otherworldly authority, but also it means that everything he said is true if he has the power to give those true signs. Because true signs cannot confirm a false prophet. If he is false, if he is a fraud, well then how can he do those things? The greatest miracle of all, of course, was the raising of a person from the dead. In other words, Jesus raising from the dead without any human intervention whatsoever. There is no greater miracle possible. And the reason for that is because it requires supreme mastery, not only over the physical realm, the body itself, but also over the spiritual realm. We all know that intuitively, if nothing else, that when the body dies, the spirit goes somewhere else. Well, here's a man who brought that spirit from wherever else it goes back to the body and presented himself alive. Who can do that? Who has authority to do that? Who has a power to do that? In Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 3 and 4, it says that after the gospel was first spoken through the Lord, it was confirmed to us, the writer says, by those who heard, God also testifying with them, both by signs and wonders and by various miracles, by gifts of the Holy Spirit according to his own will. Not only did Jesus work miracles, but so did his hand-picked spokesman work miracles. And all that to prove that this message that we are preaching, this is the revealed message of God. Who else could provide such power? Who else could give such authority for us to do such thing? Who else could say what we have to say? Unless, of course, there is a God, and he is very much alive, and this is from him. All of this is recorded in the New Testament. John chapter 20, verse 31, John says, in essence, that this is all written so that you may believe in exactly what we are just talking about. That you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Redeemer, and the Son of God. He is a divine personage. Christians have a reason, then, to believe. God just doesn't tell us to believe. He doesn't just say, believe, right? He gives us a reason to believe. Remember what we said, a reason to believe. Remember where the world's coming from. Everything's irrational. It's all made up. It's all supposed. It's all subjective. And then God comes along. Remember, we're supposed to be the irrational ones because we have faith. And then God comes along and gives us a reason, a rational premise to believe in him. We don't need to invent blind forces of nature. to make this work. We don't need some Big Bang story to make this work. And we don't need to look for aliens to validate our existence. We have a living and true God who actually says all of this is true. You know, another amazing thing is that if every Christian in the world walked away from God and abandoned their faith in God, God's power would not be diminished in the least. Christ's authority would be fully intact. The gospel message would still be true and still believable. And yet, if every person, every godless person, abandoned his belief in atheism, humanism, evolutionism, every other ism that is out there, all man-made beliefs, these things would disappear like a rock thrown out in the middle of the ocean and no one would ever see it again. It would disappear as though it had never existed. And my question to those people would be this: why would you want to cling to something that is so weak and fragile that only human beings can prop it up, not something stronger than human beings? And again, when a person dies and leaves this world, what happens to them and how does anyone know that? Non-Christians might speculate and have their opinions, but the afterlife doesn't care about your speculations and it doesn't care about your opinions and it's certainly not going to cater to them. The only factual information that we have about the afterlife is given to us by God himself. The question comes down then, who are you going to trust? Who should you trust? The God of the Bible doesn't think like us, he doesn't act like us, he doesn't live like us because he's higher than us. And therefore he's stronger than us, he's smarter than us, he's more capable than us. He doesn't consult us to learn what is best or what is wisest, but he already knows those things. And moreover, because he's stronger and wiser and more capable, he's not obligated to fulfill our human and earthly and finite and, yes, often self-serving expectations of him and his word and his church and his decisions. I'm not saying he doesn't care about what we think. What I'm saying is it really doesn't matter what we think in the end. It doesn't change who he is, and it doesn't change what he's going to do. He does what he does, and we cannot stop him. Turn your Bible to 1 John chapter 4, verse 4 through 6, if you would. 1 John chapter 4, starting in verse 4, and listen to what the Apostle John says here. That's very relevant to what we're saying now. He says, "You are from God, little children, and have overcome them," those who oppose Christ, "because greater is he who is in you than he who is in the world. They are from the world, therefore they speak as from the world, and the world listens to them. We are from God. He who knows God listens to us," us being really the apostles. "He who is not from God does not listen to us, and by this we know the spirit of truth and the spirit of error." Non-Christian, unbelieving in God, that is, or unbelieving in the Bible message here, they gravitate or they side with those who are most like themselves. They side with, well, not surprisingly, other non-Christian, unbelieving people. And this assumes that just because those people have numbers and popularity on their side, therefore they must be right. And remember what we said already, that God does not rule by majority vote. He is a sovereign authority who answers to no one. It doesn't really matter how many people gang up on him. He's already stronger than all of them. Here's another passage over here in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, where Paul says something significant about really our perspective as thinking people here, if I can say it that way. 1 Corinthians chapter 2 and starting in verse 12, he says, "Now we have received not the spirit of the world, but the spirit who is from God, so that we may know the things freely given to us by God, which things we also speak, not in words taught by human wisdom, but in those taught by the Spirit, combining spiritual thoughts with spiritual words. But a natural man," in other words, a man who is unconverted to thinking this way or unprepared to think this way, "does not accept the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness to him, and he cannot understand them because they are spiritually appraised." Secular-minded, unchristian, unconverted, ungodly people cannot appraise, which means to really evaluate properly, that which is spiritual or heavenly in nature, simply because they're not trained to think this way. It's not because Christians are more intelligent than such people. I'm here to tell you, we're not, okay? Not only from my own personal experience, but also, you know, just watching all of us over the years. We're just not the most intelligent people on the earth. There's more intelligent people out there, okay? But we have been trained by the Word to see things for how they are, not just how they appear to us at first. We have accepted the proofs which have led to the premise that there is a God, He does exist, and what He does say is true because that premise is true. We followed that premise. We followed that chain there. And so can you. You, meaning anyone, so can anyone do that same thing. This is not an elitist group where only so many people can come in, or only so a certain kind of people can come in. It's really open to anyone who will accept the premise and believe in this message. The world thinks that it sees just fine, and yet it is blinded to its worst problem. And the problem is not all the vices of the world. Really, the problem comes down to one thing, and that is sin. That's the problem right there. Jesus healed a blind man here in John chapter 9, and Jesus says to him at the end of that chapter, he says, "For judgment I came into this world so that those who do not see may see, that those who see may become blind." Those of the Pharisees who were with him heard these things and said, "We are not blind too, are we?" Jesus said to them, "If you were blind, you would have no sin, but since you say we see, your sin remains." Well, if you want a paradoxical statement, well, there it is. Here's people who thought that they could see. They thought they had all the answers. They thought they had everything together. And Jesus says, "You guys are so blind, you can't even see your own problem." But if you truly were blind, in the sense of blind to the thinking of the world and blind to the expectations of the world, and start looking at God instead, then you would see everything clearly. It's really what he's saying. You know, there's an excellent view into the paradoxical nature of the Christian faith as Jesus defined it in what is called the Beatitudes. The Beatitudes isn't a Bible word. It's actually a Latin word, which came later. It literally means happy statements, okay? Blessed statements. In Matthew chapter 5, verse 3 through 12, you see a series of blessed statements, like blessed are the poor in spirit, the humble, the lowly, not those who are wise in their own estimation. This is completely backward from the world, and yet very forward-thinking and progressive and actually transcendent in nature. Transcendent meaning above all of this, something we actually appeal to, but we don't control. Pride, arrogance, boasting, these all contribute to man's downfall, not to our success, and such people will not be in the kingdom of God. Jesus says it's different than how you think. Things are not always as they seem. Blessed are those who mourn, not who merely feel sorry for themselves or sorrowful for what has happened to them, but these people mourn and grieve over the pain that they've inflicted against God himself, which necessitated his son going to the cross. And they grieve over that. They don't just look at that and go, "Oh, the world has been so unfair and unjust to me," but rather, "I have been so unfair and unjust to my God that he had to die for me in order for me to be saved." Blessed are those people. The world only mourns over what it has lost or what it cannot have, but simply fails to take responsibility for what it has done. Blessed are the gentle, really the meek, those who show kindness and patience and toleration, not towards sin, but rather towards sinners, toward human frailty, human imperfections. I think you probably know what I'm talking about. You might have seen some of that out in the world, right? The world is anything but meek. All terrorism, for example, especially that in the name of God, is in violation of this virtue. And yet if the world were filled with gentle people, it would be an excellent place to live. Here the world is criticizing Christians and they're saying, "You've got a backward gospel," and yet it wants exactly what we have to offer, what we practice, what we teach, what God has revealed. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Well, this has nothing to do with hungering and thirsting literally, physically, but it talks about really the cravings of the soul that can only be satisfied by a divine being who validates and nourishes us, not by some aliens flying around in a flying saucer who came from some other constellation, but a loving and powerful creator who has given us life and actually wants our fellowship. And we hunger and thirst for our fellowship with that Creator. We hunger and thirst for that. The world tries to fill its hunger and thirst with longing for and longing with sensuality, philosophy, emotion, religion, addictions, narcotics. You might ask the Dr. Phil question, "How's that working for you? How is that working for you?" Because it's not working at all. Blessed are the merciful. Mercy is related to grace, but not interchangeable. Grace gives us something we don't deserve. Mercy actually withholds from us what we do deserve. Blessed are the merciful, namely those who withhold punishment for crimes and sins and offenses in hopes of reform, in hopes that the person from which that punishment is withheld will change his heart and become more like God. Most of the modern world is fueled by bloodthirsty vengeance and retaliation, escalating violence, riots, and rebellion. We have seen that even recently here in our own country, sadly. And yet this is backward. An ideal society would not have such things. Christianity promotes an ideal society. Blessed are the pure in heart, not merely people with good intentions, but people who are innocent of evil. These are not the same things. Good intentions and innocent of evil are not the same thing. Purity is a noble virtue, a characteristic of God and his people, yet the world is anything but innocent or pure. Instead, it thrives on being as crude and sacrilegious and profane and irreverent as possible. We live in a gutter mentality right now. Our world is drowning in filth and sacrilege. Look at the TV shows. Look at the movies. Look at the literature that's being put out. Look at our comedians. They can't wait to trash and make fun of anything that is sacred. Blessed are the peacemakers. We're not talking about brokers of political peace between nations. We're talking about personal peace between you and your fellow man. Romans 12, verse 18 says, if possible, Paul says, so far as it depends on you, be at peace with all men. Christianity is foolish and irrational, we're told, and yet what does it promote? It promotes peace between people, which would promote peace between nations, which if everyone believed in it and followed it, would give us truly world peace. Many claim they want peace, but they're not willing to do what that takes to achieve peace. You can't be a genuine peacemaker when you're living selfishly and unforgivingly and in rebellion to your own creator. That is not peace. You'll never be at peace in that case. World peace is impossible until everyone seeks peace with his fellow man based on a greater peace with his God in heaven, because it is impossible otherwise. And blessed are those who are persecuted for the sake of righteousness. And Jesus says, because of me. This is not talking about people who are persecuted for stupid ideas and false religion and pointless or useless causes. It's not talking about that. Persecution in this case is harassment or express hatred or violence toward those who differ in religion, social outlook, or origin, specifically about Christians who hold to their faith. The New Testament calls this trials, tribulation, testing for Christians. The paradox is this, that the ungodly, unconverted world is the source of all Christian persecution. And yet if everyone believed in the gospel and modeled himself after Jesus Christ and lived as a faithful Christian, this would be a beautiful place to live. This would be like heaven on earth if everyone did that. Many despise Christians and their gospel, and yet it is these people that add virtue and civility to our society. Christian influence is not noticed only when it's present. It's also noticed when it's absent. We are actually helping to add some decency to the world because of what we are taught by God. If we were all gone, you can believe what the world would turn into, a bunch of barbaric anarchists, and it would be an ugly, awful existence. While the world lives in defiance of God, Christians live in defiance of worldly thinking. While the world thinks Christianity is backward, actually it's the world that is backward and upside down, filled with lies, filled with deceptions, filled with delusion, filled with contradictions. And so, yes, we will be fools for Christ's sake in the eyes of the world. Let the world think whatever it wants to. And yet snubbing or spitting in the face of an all-powerful being who you cannot control, cannot destroy, and cannot escape, and before whom you will stand trial, that's a pretty foolish way to live. We choose to suffer, not needlessly or hopelessly or irresponsibly, but purposely. What we achieve through suffering for what is right is infinitely greater than what we will achieve by avoiding that and by our own self-protection. We will choose to hate our friends, exactly the opposite of what the world teaches, and yet this is absolutely necessary, as in the right context, if we're going to sanctify Christ as Lord. He cannot have a place among our friends. He has to have a place higher than our friends. We will love our enemies, exactly the opposite of what the world teaches, and yet exactly what God does and what God teaches. The world is sinking in darkness and filth and hatred. God lives in light and joy and peace. Which sounds better to you? We will cling to and preach the scandalous word of the cross, the message that divides humankind into two groups, those who love and obey Jesus Christ for his selfless sacrifice, and then everyone else for any reason. We love, we respect, we boldly proclaim exactly what the world hates and despises and rejects. We denounce the wisdom of a doomed world, the world that's groping in moral darkness, that's filled with satanic lies and drowning in its own sins. We realize we are not perfect people. We know that. We Christians are not perfect people, but we do believe in a perfect Savior and a perfect gospel. And we are trying very hard to not only preach that gospel, we are trying very hard to emulate that gospel. And yet, even though the world rejects Christ, loathes the gospel, ridicules Christians, he who is coming will indeed come. We are not here to defend ourselves. We are not here to vindicate ourselves. God will do that for us in due time. We do believe that. I've spoken strongly tonight against the world's view, not out of vindictive moral superiority. That's not it. But to really wake up whoever is listening, given what is at stake. We must not be afraid of difficult questions. We must not be afraid of this kind of discussion. We're very similar to Paul in this way. Paul says we are ambassadors for Christ, as though God were making an appeal through us. We beg you on behalf of Christ, be reconciled to God. That's really where we're at. That's certainly where I'm at tonight. And the world deems this to be foolish and hopeless and irrational, but God's message is about your salvation. Remember, and we'll say this again, it's going to come up again in the lessons this weekend. God does love the world, and therefore he loves you, but he does not love what the world has become, and he will not save you just because he loves you. 1 John 2:17 really captures the full summary of this whole opening message here. Whatever the godless, unchristian world thinks of Christ and the churches of Christ and the gospel of Christ, our plea itself, the fact remains, and this is not going away, that the world is passing away and also its lust, but the one who does the will of the Lord, the will of God, lives forever. You have a choice to make. Everyone has a choice to make. And given all that we have said, we ask that you choose wisely where you go from here, that you not take the path of least resistance, that you take the path that leads to life, that leads to heaven, that leads to God. This is what Christ lived for. This is also what Christ died for. And that's our message tonight. And Kyle, you have a song for us. We're going to ask you to stand, please, and then Kyle, lead us in that song. If there's anyone that